Welcome to the AKC Podcast, an audio resource for the King's community following the Associateship of King's College programme. The AKC is an inclusive, research-led programme of lectures which explore diverse religious and cultural perspectives. For more information, visit kcl.ac.uk/AKC. Lecture resources and further reading links for this lecture are available on the AKC Keats area.
I have to apologize. There's so many false promises. The topic was meant to be justice. And as I started writing and putting together my slides, I realized that some of the underlying concepts that I need to work on to explain to you to get to those visions of justice might need more time. And so perhaps it's better if I take a step back and talk about some of those underlying ideas that have actually been in some ways been presented and framed within the concept of tolerance. So I'll start with this. I think it's important that you get a sense of where I'm coming from to understand the kinds of connections and the kinds of arguments that I'll be presenting here. I think it's really important, and in my work I try to think about political theory beyond Europe. Now, this is a more complicated project than you might imagine, because political theory remains a steadfastly and somewhat stubbornly Eurocentric discipline. And what that means is that not only do we often think about philosophies and philosophical thinking as the preserve of textual traditions in particular, but often the concepts, the categories, the frameworks, the normative commitments that we take for granted have a deeply European, are built on deeply European experiences that have then been universalized as a through the process of colonialism, right? So even though those experiences were quite particular, they tend to be presented as and seen as universal. Whereas if we look at, say, South Asia or, say, the Islamic tradition or the Hindu tradition, we might think of them as more particular, as something that is relevant only to Muslims or only to Hindus or only to Buddhists. Ideas that come from South Asia or Africa as ideas that are relevant only for Africans or only for South Asians. And so to try and move beyond that, I think it's really useful and important to do that. But it's also a really difficult project because, especially over the last 200 years or so, there's been a lot of co-imbrication of ideas. Ideas have traveled, have merged, have changed shape, and so that's also important, important to think about. I use these two maps quite a lot in my teaching as well to just signal to us, to ourselves, that there are, when I say that various categories, concepts, frameworks have been naturalized, it's quite useful to think of something that we think of as scientific knowledge, which is maps, you know, geographical knowledge. We think of the category continent, and the general definition of that category is that this is a large landmass surrounded by water on all sides. And yet we continue to think of Europe as a continent as well. So if you look at the map, either of them, you'll see that Europe could quite easily be also thought of as a subcontinent of Asia, because there's no clear division between Europe and Asia. The part of the world that I come from, my family comes from, is South Asia, and for a long time, South Asia has been called a subcontinent. Because of the idea that it's a huge landmass, it's very diverse, etc., but it is part of Asia, it's a subcontinent. And those are the kinds of categories, those are the kinds of concepts that are actually are a legacy of colonialism, where certain colonial hubris about what counts as a continent, what counts as any, what kinds of exceptions are allowed to a category, seem to apply to Europe and not to other parts of the world. Now, the map on that side, on the right, is the Mercator projection, and that is the projection that we often see and use in various kind of schools and universities here. because the Earth is a sphere, when you flatten it out to present it on paper, there are various choices that have to be made about how this three-dimensional, spherical space will be presented on a flat surface. The Mercator projection elongates, expands parts of the world that are on the top and on the south and the north pole, with the result that Greenland appears to be quite big. Actually, Britain appears to be quite big as well. And South Asia appears to be quite small. This is the Peters projection. The Peters projection is another way of presenting this map where the north and the south pole are not elongated. And in this, you will see South Asia is actually much bigger. It is India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Nepal, Sri Lanka together can almost be in this map as big as Europe. It's Europe, the continent of Europe, right? And not only is this geographically quite a big space, it is actually an immensely diverse space. There are multiple religious traditions, multiple ethnic groups, multiple languages that inhabit this subcontinent of South Asia. So the starting point here, what I'm trying to do is to present to you that there are certain ideas that we take for granted. It is important that we open them up to think about why we think about these categories that we take for granted in particular ways and how colonial ideas may be embedded in those categories. And then the second point that I wanted to introduce to you here was the question of the size of South Asia and the diversity that is already embedded within it. And the diversity question is something that I will come back to when we think about the question of tolerance. Now, I focus on South Asian Islamic thought. And this is also something that a little bit of a case needs to be made for. In Euro-American academic study, Islamic thought has been studied primarily in the Middle East. The Middle East is seen as the locus of Islamic thought. But I argue that over the last two centuries, innovation in Islamic thought have actually come from South Asia. Whether we're thinking of new schools of thought, such as the Barelvi or the Deobandi, whether we are thinking about new organizational entities, organizational innovations, a whole host of innovations have come from the South Asian context. And I think it is a particularly interesting context precisely because in the Middle East, the main interlocutors in terms of religious traditions were other Abrahamic faiths, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. But when you move further eastwards, we're actually getting into Vedic traditions, Dharmic traditions, and that interaction and that engagement has been particularly fruitful and generative, quite apart from other aspects, you know, including the fact that this is an area that has been important for world trade, for various other reasons that have also allowed it greater vibrancy for the last several centuries. And one of the tropes of Orientalist writing or colonial writing about the Islamic tradition as well as other Dharmic traditions in the South Asian context was that there is too much dispute, there is too much debate, that, you know, in the Islamic context that there are multiple schools of jurisprudence, there are two big streams, the Shia and the Sunni, and then within the Sunni there are at least five different schools of jurisprudence, and so there is no singularity, homogeneous vision of what is Islam, and that was often presented as a failure, as a lack. And I think it's important that we twist that Orientalist colonial frame around and actually recognize that this debate, this lack of a complete agreement, this questioning of various concepts and ideas within the Islamic tradition is actually a sign of vibrancy. Because when you stop having questions within a tradition, when you stop having debate within a tradition, that's when a tradition is dead. when it is actually really a museum piece rather than an actual living tradition. So as long as people are finding new questions, new problems, new answers within a tradition, then in fact that is what a living tradition really comprises of. So I argue for understanding, recognizing, and working with the vibrancy of South Asian Islamic thought in particular. And in that context, in recognizing the diversity that has been a feature of Islamicate South Asia, I want to then think about a very different conception of tolerance. Now, when we think about tolerance, the concept of tolerance, we often actually use it interchangeably with liberal, right? So we often say to be liberal is to be tolerant. If somebody is very tolerant, we say, oh, they're very liberal. In common use, we fuse the two terms together. And that is partly because from the 20th century onwards, this has been part of kind of a framing of liberalism, that liberalism is ultimately primarily a tolerant tradition, the key feature of liberal tradition is, or the key virtue in liberal tradition is tolerance. And, you know, here are a few political theorists who've made the argument that tolerance is a liberal virtue, or that liberals can be frequently defined as those who value liberty and toleration. This is true that even though there are longer histories that are written, from the mid-20th century onwards, as the Cold War progressed, and as part of the dynamics of Cold War, tolerance was increasingly highlighted as a liberal virtue to separate it from the homogenizing impulse of Soviet Union. But prior to that, the record for tolerance in liberalism is deeply fragmented, right? The British Empire, for instance, was a liberal empire, but racism, various forms of discrimination were endemic to it. We know that in Britain itself, until the 1970s in particular, but much later as well, it was not uncommon to have placards in houses or in public spaces that said, you know, no dogs or Irish and blacks, right? So the idea that liberalism is somehow the preserve of European liberal thinking, tolerance is the preserve of European liberal thinking and practice only, is something that I question. But I question not just by questioning, not just by raising a critique, but by also fleshing out an alternative vision, because I think it's really important that we go beyond that impulse to critique and we also come up with more kind of positive alternatives that one can engage with and think with. So I want to highlight very quickly what is particular to liberal visions of tolerance. Liberal visions of tolerance are predicated on the idea of freedom of individual conscience, right? It is the individual's faith, belief, ideas, ultimately, that liberal protection protects, or liberal protection works for. So liberal tolerance is predicated on the idea of freedom of individual conscience, and that is ultimately, and now there is a lot of debate about whether tolerance really means this kind of that particular freedom of individual conscience, or something more than that. Is tolerance really about, you know, a celebration of diversity, etc.? That's an ongoing debate, and both in the public and in political theory spheres. But the minimal common denominator that we can see in liberal conceptions of tolerance is that it is about individual freedom of conscience. And that, I argue, is tied to a very specific history, that is European history, where we had a church and an empire, the Roman Church, the Roman Empire and the Catholic Church come together. It's a highly centralized church. It's an imperial and centralized church. The Inquisition, the institution of the Inquisitions, which was a feature for not just a few years, but several centuries, that interrogated the individual conscience. wars of religion that became a feature of European history, Reformation and the acrimony that came with it, as well as this kind of founding narrative of the Enlightenment, where all that was associated with religion was deeply problematic, and Enlightenment philosophers looked to move beyond that. That particular history forms a background and forms the historical context in which the idea of tolerance as the freedom of the individual to hold particular beliefs, as long as they are not necessarily practicing them in the public, becomes entrenched, right? So if you think about Locke, who is a very influential theorist of toleration, he is not suggesting that heterogeneous or diverse societies are a positive. He actually thinks, ideally, we would all be homogenous. But if we can't be homogenous, then all he is proposing is that the magistrate, the state's operative, does not have any right in accessing what I'm thinking and doing in my home in terms of my private belief. So that's one history. If we look at the other photograph, so that's the black and white photo. They're not black and white in color because of any kind of normative value that I want to attach to them, just that these were the images that I could find. The black and white image is an image of debates during the period of Reformation. This is obviously many of these debates then spilled out into wars. And one of the reasons for these wars was the idea that the prince had to ideally... the religion of the prince should be followed, or prayer of the king should be followed by the population. Now, in contrast, we have in the Islamic context, the first thing to recognize is that there is no pope. There is no equivalent of that centralized hierarchical control particularly for Sunni Islam, pretty much throughout the Islamic history, right? There is no clear hierarchy of the clergy. Again, there are differences in Shia and Sunni Islam, but in Sunni Islamic practice and thought over the last 1400 and so years, there is no clear hierarchy. The various ulama who are scholars of Islam, there's no way of knowing who is more authoritative than others, apart from in the way that we academics sometimes recognize each other as some people having more knowledge, being able to solve more complicated problems. But there is no clerical hierarchy in Islam. The other important thing to notice about Sharia, which is often when we hear about Sharia in mainstream media especially, we are told that Sharia is a set of laws. Sharia is a set of principles that are interpreted for particular situations. And for most of Islamic history, Sharia has not been imposed by the state. Now, that explains partly the continued vibrancy of Sharia, the reason why in various parts of the world people still go back and say that we prefer Sharia to, say, the state-operated mechanisms of providing justice that may be very expensive, that may be very difficult to reach, etc. And this is not to say that Sharia is, provides perfect justice, but just to suggest to you that there is an important element of difference, which is that in Islamic thought and practice, Sharia has not been primarily imposed by the state. And the clergy has not been primarily either hierarchical or associated with the state. So there is a big difference. The other big difference that happened actually European Christianity also is very different from Christianity elsewhere in the world, right? So what I'm contrasting with here is not Christianity in Islam, but European experiences with other parts of the world, and then with a specific mention with the Islamic tradition. The other thing that happened in Islamic history that allowed an acceptance of diversity is the fact that the Islamic Empire, for various contingent reasons, spread very quickly. So both the Roman and the Sassanid empires fell for various internal as well as external reasons. And the Islamic empire spread over vast regions very quickly. And at that point, there was a debate about whether whether these new Muslim rulers should try to convert the local populations. And because the task was so impossible, given the other kind of challenges of expanding the empire, they let that go, right? So the dominant practice that emerged from that context was there was no impetus to convert populations to Islam. And what that meant is that when Islam, actually the 700, almost 700 years of Muslim rule in Europe were actually also very different from the life of the church in Europe, the Catholic Church, particularly in Europe. So this is an image the best term is to use an emperor from associated with the Umayyad Caliphate, and this is in Spanish. This is a photograph of Cordoba, and the ambassador, the Basque ambassador, is being presented to the emperor. Now, this was a court in which Jews, Muslims, and Christians actually flourished together. And in fact, when the Islamic Empire in Europe falls, and when I say 700 years of rule, this is quite an expansive, it expands and it contracts, but certainly large parts of Spain, Portugal, France, some parts of Germany at one point, parts of Austria were under this Islamic Empire, and of course other parts of Eastern Europe were later under the Ottoman Empire, right? When this falls in 1492 is a very interesting date, because when this falls, when the Islamic Empire ends in 1492, is the date when also the conquering Ferdinand and Isabella, the conquering monarchs, actually send out Christopher Columbus to go look for India, actually, and he ends up in South America and ends up, and suddenly, you know, the Spanish Empire gets a lot of resources, but we also have, precisely at that moment, the institutionalizations of inquisitions. And what are the inquisitions doing? The inquisitions are saying that you're Spanish, you don't have the Spanish national frame at that point, but you look like you're from here. But are you a Jew or a Muslim? And so we will check to confirm. You say you are Christian, but are you really? And that again tells you something about that difference, even within that same geographical space of these kinds of two institutional mechanisms and institutional histories that develop. And so the freedom of individual conscience becomes prized in that context, whereas in the Islamic context, and we see with, there are other problems. This is not to say that there are no problems, but there are other problems. At least in this count, there is an acceptance of diversity. There is no interest in, there's no celebration of diversity, but there is an acceptance of diversity. Which is why after the Inquisitions, when many Jews flee from Europe, they actually end up in these Muslim-controlled areas in North Africa and the Middle East, all the way to South Asia as well later on. And so there's a very different dynamic in terms of how to deal with diversity. Now we see that playing out in the South Asian context with the Mughal Empire, which was one of the very magnificent empires. I mean, when I say this is not to glorify the Mughal Empire, because empires are empires, and they have their deeply problematic aspects. All pre-modern empires in general, or the early kind of early modern pre-colonial empires in Asia, at least, tended to be much more comfortable with ethnic, linguistic, religious diversity, right? So we have, this is an account from a Hindu court secretary of the Emperor Shah Jahan, and he's just talking about, this is from his memoirs, and he's talking about the various people who are part of the emperor's court. So he's saying, you know, eminent scholars, elite sayyids, great sheikhs, ingenious doctors, and agreeable courtiers of various classes from Arabia and Ajam, Turks, Tajiks, Kurds, Georgians, Tatars, Russians, Ethiopians, Circassians, and various others from the lands of Rome, Egypt, Egypt, Syria, Iraq, Arabia, Ajam, Persia, Gilan, Mazandaran, Khurasan, Transoxania, the Kipchak steppes, Turkestan, Georgia, Kurdistan. And he says, then he gives us a list of non-Muslims, the various Rajputs, Ranas, Rajas, Raos, Rais, Rathors, Sisodias, etc. This is a hugely multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multilingual court. And this is about the time of, if you compare the court in England at that time, we are at that point already at a stage where you cannot be explicitly Catholic if you want to be part of the court, right? So there are different histories of a level of comfort with diversity that are playing out here. And actually, because we often forget that when the Europeans first came to South Asia, they were also, you know, for several hundred years, they were there as traders, scholars, as missionaries, not as imperial and colonizing agents. And so they learned a lot. So Sir Thomas Rowe, who was an ambassador to the Mughal court from the court of James I, went back, and some decades later, after spending time, he spent a few years in the court of Jahangir, I think. And when he went back, he actually made the argument in the English Parliament saying, we should learn from what the Mughals are doing. What the Mughals are doing is that they are not prohibiting people on the basis of their religion from taking part in government, taking part in trade, taking part in the economy, or taking part in society. And he is particularly concerned with the effect on the economy, right? So he says, and he's making the argument here with reference to skilled workers from Netherlands, he says, if we in England want to develop our industry, we have to let go of this kind of desire to have people who are practicing exactly the same version of religion as us. We have to let them in to be able to develop our own industry. So he's actually going back from the Mughal court and trying to actually implement some of these ideas that he's learned there. Similarly, Giles Shute, who was a Catholic pamphleteer, you know, his historic detail is, he says there are 88 several castes of persons. I mean, the number 88 is historically inaccurate, but similarly, he's making the argument that under the great Mughal, there's huge variation. There are sects and opinions, etc., but they don't prosecute, he's saying, and I'm quoting from here, they do not persecute or molest or meddle one with the powers of persuasion or opinion in that way and manner, but are all subject to the higher powers, and the government takes no notice of their several opinions or castes, one more than another, right? So this is a context where they go to the Mughal court and they learn. So in the Mughal court, for instance, the political elite, the various ministers are across the religious kind of spectrum within South Asia. The economic elite does not have to be Muslim and is not primarily Muslim. The military elite is not primarily Muslim, right? So there is a greater comfort with diversity that we see in that context. Now, what does this all tell us? Can we think of this historical experience by itself as a vision of tolerance? I think we need to do more, right? We can see that this historical experience is different. And we can see why certain visions of tolerance may not hold a lot of appeal given different historical experience, but what else can we take out of this? Now, one of the things that we see is that there is continuation of certain norms of everyday practice. These are given the range of diversity, given the range of ethnic and linguistic and religious diversity that is a norm in South Asia, and there is also immense violence, right? So this is not to present a romanticized vision, but to actually highlight the fact that there is actually a lot of diversity that we don't often recognize, that which is diverse communities and peoples living together, and potentially there could be more violence, but there isn't, right? So what are those norms and practices that allow so much diversity and so much difference to live, to be inhabited together? Now, one of the things that we see from some of the recent work that has come up, I've put up Anna Bigelow's work because I really like that book. It was it's a really interesting ethnography of Malerkotla. It's a small town in northern India in Punjab, somewhat roughly equally divided between Hindus and Sikhs and Muslims. And there's a sense of ownership that is structured around the Sufi saints' shrine there. The shrine acts as a kind of a public space as well as a spiritual peg for the community. And she's done this detailed ethnography of how people tend to come together while also recognizing difference, right? There is a deep investment in difference. We are not to be the same. This is not a vision of tolerance in which ideally we would all be the same. In fact, there is great investment in the fact that we are different and that maybe there are irreconcilable differences. But how do we then still continue to live together? And this is where at least one of these instances and one of these contexts where a certain understanding of spiritual and ethical responsibility plays an important role in how they interact with each other. Which is not to say that in terms of daily interaction, people will not have rivalries, they will fight, they will, et cetera, et cetera. But this doesn't become inured in this kind of, in a religious war or division entirely. And I put up the other really famous image of this is a miniature painting with Jahangir sitting with one of his with a Hindu sadhu Jadroop, and the image is quite striking. You know, Jadroop wears no clothes at all. Jahangir is decked out in his jewels and his fine clothes, etc. But still, he's actually sitting as an equal with this person who has no clothes, no jewels at all. And what this is a recognition of is of the spiritual power of the sadhu, in front of which the sovereign, the king at that point, is also in a sense recognizing and kneeling. And the foreground of the painting, you will see, is crowded with courtiers and people who have accompanied Jahangir to the sadhu's hut, but then have gone no further. They have been kept away while the king actually has this private conversation with the sadhu. And the idea there and in Anna Bigelow's work is that what permeates some of this interaction is the idea of ethical perfection, right? That you recognize and that you try to cultivate ethical perfection. So there's a different vision of tolerance that is at play. What I think is really interesting to think about then is our different concepts. And one of the concepts within the Islamic terminology that I think is quite a useful, multifaceted concept. So we can have words that have often singular meanings and concepts that actually bring an array of meanings within them. And khushu, I think, is a concept that denotes primarily that sense of epistemic humility. So the tolerance that we can, in a sense, think about, the practices, the norm of tolerance that we can think about from contemporary South Asian context, particularly from South Asian Islamic debates and practices, is something like khushu, which is really epistemic humility, which is saying there are differences. I can't know for sure if my version of the truth is better than your version of the truth. I am committed to my version of truth. I will lead my life based on what I think is that version, that truth. But I cannot know for sure if your version of truth may also be equally true or somewhat true. And so it is that sense of epistemic humility, which is really kind of linked to an idea of ethical perfection, of wanting to improve ourselves as individuals, as communities, not necessarily only or primarily in material terms, but also in ethical terms, that is less about entitlement and more about responsibility, that is really predicated on some vision of the divine. And, you know, this is the other, I think, relatively underexplored aspect of tolerance, and debates about toleration and tolerance in the European context, that over time there is there's a discomfort with religious ideas, right? That the idea that religious ideas will inevitably be regressive, will hold us back, etc. And so if we park that, that is a European experience, and we can park that for a while, and we can look at how people approach these ideas in other parts of the world, we can see great enthusiasm for, you know, some of these ideas. And so the idea of a connection with the divine that spurs people to be more ethically engaged, to be more, to improve themselves ethically, is something that actually has wide purchase, right? So at this point, at a philosophical level, I am not making an argument whether that is right or wrong. All I'm putting out for you to consider is that it has wide purchase. Many people, billions of people in the South Asian context, because just India's population is a billion, and then, you know, Pakistan is 250 million. So, well, let's say millions of people, at the very least, find these ideas plausible and important, that there is some divine, that we have some connection with that divine. As part of that connection with the divine, we should be looking at our ethical improvement. And one aspect of that ethical improvement is that we cannot know for sure. We can commit to a particular way of life, but we cannot know for sure if that is the only and the best way of life. And so that epistemic humility that is denoted by the concept of khushu in Islamic thought, I think, is another version of tolerance. It is not predicated on individual freedom of conscience. It may actually require various kinds of social and public commitments and performances, but it is not necessarily committed to the idea that the individual's conscience requires to be free and protected in that sense. I will stop here. I realize I'm already a bit above time, and I'm happy to take any questions that you might have. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the AKC podcast. If you have enjoyed this lecture, please click subscribe in your podcast app to receive future episodes. AKC, at the heart of King's thinking.